And so I share the story when I met Kirk Douglas, the actor, and we were on the rooftop. We were going to have Friday night dinner together, went to the rooftop, and Kirk turns to me and says, starts singing, L'chuna ranana l'ashem na'ria, looks really shame there. I'm looking at him like, what? What is he doing? And he said to me, Rabbi, I know my lines in Judaism. You see, I remember the songs that you sing Friday night. But it's all form, no content. I said, oh. So I said, well, Kirk, let me ask you a question. I said, imagine if you were to base your budget on your understanding of money as a child. Right? What would you be spending your money on today? He said, well, junk. I said, okay. I said, imagine, Kirk, if you were to base your diet on your understanding of food as a child, what would you be eating today? He said, well, I'd be eating junk. I said, right. So I said, so Kirk, imagine if you were to base your Jewish identity on your understanding of being Jewish as a child, what would it be? He said, okay, Rabbi, checkmate. I said, I'm not, I don't mean that. I'm not playing chess here. I'm just asking a question. I'm just saying, oh, he says, are you trying to tell me that I should grow up? Right? I said, oh no, I'm not saying that at all. I said, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, listen, we all have to mature. We all have to evolve. Right? And the images that we have aren't always align with where we are in our journey as we know ourselves more and more, and we know who we're part of more and more, and we just try to express it in words, and that's really that's the point. Emunah is higher than a concept. It's not a concept really. It's a thinking. It's consciousness itself, right? And as you evolve in your consciousness, the external forms of how you express that and how you feel that, right, is very different. And that's good. But that becomes the challenge. That becomes the challenge of religious education today. Can we teach Torah today exactly the way we taught Torah 100 years ago? Right? And it's the same Torah. But maybe it's a little different emphasis. And that's really the challenge as we evolve spiritually. So I saw a really fascinating idea from a priest who wrote a book about the evolution of religiosity. Made a very interesting point. He said, originally mankind was primitive, wild, right? So religion comes to tame the beast, right? And introduce us to the moral soul, right? And that's the role that religious education plays, to tame the beast. But what happens when the beast is tamed and we get back to, yeah, right, that's what I am. You know, I'm a moral being. So then what happens is, well, then I don't need religion anymore. I don't need religion to tell me don't kill. I know in myself not to kill. I don't need religion to tell me don't steal. That's the obvious moral sensitivities of any human being, right? So I don't need religion, and I certainly don't need God to be my police guard, right? And look over my shoulders making sure I do that, right? So what happens is, he says that man originally, in a primitive state, turns to religion to tame the beasts and access the moral sensitivities, the sensibilities. But then what happens is, well, I'm moral. I don't need God. I don't need religion. I don't need some external structure, because I'm a human being. I'm sophisticated. I'm not a beast. But what happens is that person then throws out God. Well, then I don't need God, because I don't need a police God. But then what happens is mankind goes into a state of meaninglessness, because, well, but okay, now that I'm moral, do I have any meaning? Right? Do I have any purpose? I threw out God as a police God, as some authoritative figure to keep me in line, right? But now I'm wondering, to keep me in line for what? What am I doing here? Am I just a speck of dust? Does this universe mean anything? Do I mean anything? And so he says that then man turns to religion for mystical meaning, right? Not for morality, but for spirituality. And this is what this particular priest believes has to be the new marketing or role of religious education. Not so much from the point of, you guys got to be moral and remember there's some God that's going to wipe you out if you don't get your act together. But this is a whole new awakening of ourselves that before we knew that we needed to be tamed. And religion empowers us to no longer be that beast, but to be a moral being. And then we say, well, we don't need it anymore. But then something inside us, we realize as we go through our process of self-realization, but I'm not just a moral being, I'm a meaningful being. In order for me to be meaningful, I have to be a means to an end greater than myself. Well, what is or who is that being greater than myself? And now I turn to religion not for morality, but to enable me to express and affirm my meaning, my spiritual meaning. That's what I think is going on today, right? People feel like, you know, if I go to church or synagogue to hear about a God who will punish me if I don't do this and punish me if I don't do that, that doesn't really sit well anymore. Because I don't need that. That doesn't seem to correlate to what I'm searching for and what I need in terms of my own process of self-realization. Right? But this is the problem, because now we go to synagogue, and how many of them are spiritual? How many of them are enabling me this deep experience of truly serving God, being a vehicle, a conduit, a ray of light of that sun into the world? And that really has to change. So this is when religion breaks down. When the forms, the outer forms that we're trying to externalize in words and in concepts are no longer facilitating my process of self-realization, but I get stuck and I think that Judaism was only that, right? When it wasn't only that. It was only one way of expressing it, or one aspect that we needed to focus on now. And now, we'll focus on this and express it in this way, which is equally genuine. But this is the process. So he says in number three, the sophisticates who claim to be of little religious faith raise themselves above the lower plane of existence. Right? The portrayal of faith on the lower plane does not suit them. Right? I can't deal with some God in heaven with, you know, it doesn't speak to me anymore. That doesn't reflect or doesn't ring true in my soul. Right? While faith in its higher dimension, they're not inclined to accept. They're still not ready to accept a higher form of the religious life, right? Although they intuit that spiritually they're more evolved, they're not ready to address or to encounter a more spiritually evolved religious lifestyle. Thus, they remain suspended between contradictory concepts until their relief will come from the realm of the holy. What are the contradictory concepts? They went to Hebrew school and they heard about this big God that came down on a mountain and gave them the Torah and all that. Then they start hearing some rabbi talk about this metaphysical Or Ein Sof, you know, the vessels, the breaking of the light. And that's just like, wow, I didn't hear that in Hebrew school. And they're trapped in between, right? Because they're really ready for faith in its higher articulation, right? Because they have evolved. And this is really the struggle for all of us, I think, certainly for myself, is as we evolve and become more self-aware that we, who we are and who we're part of, then the way we celebrate Shabbat, the way we say our brachot, the way we picture God, knowing that you can't or shouldn't be picturing God, all that has to evolve to a level that's comparable to who you are at this point in your journey. Right? And that's what I hope will be the renaissance that can be inspired in Jewish living. So let's hear some questions on this.
I've always translated fear as being afraid. Like fear is...
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Is fear a healthy emotion?
Yeah.
Why?
It's for survival.
Okay, good answer. Okay, you see, New Age, I find, is very anti-fear. It's love or fear is your choice in life, right? Fear is no good. That's what I'm picking up in some of these books that I've browsed through. Maybe I'm wrong. Fear is a very healthy emotion. If a child doesn't have fear, they're going to do something that is going to hurt themselves. Okay? You should be afraid of fire. But you shouldn't be afraid of lighting the stove, because that's sick. But you should know that you're playing with fire, and you could get hurt. So you need to know how to interact with that. Right? So it's really good to be open to the world. But do you want to train your, do you want to raise a child that's just so open to the world and you tell them, don't be afraid of anybody? I mean, those are the kids that get sucked into some terrible situations because, hey, you know, like, be careful because you could get hurt. So there is something or someone to fear. But there are consequences that are worth fearing could happen to you. So fear is healthy. Guilt, which is another thing that people are against. I once read a book on macrobiotics. I don't know why, but this guy writing this book on macrobiotics starts knocking guilt as the source of problems in the universe today. What does it have to do with food? I don't know. But he really went off on this whole discussion, this anti-guilt thing. Guilt is a healthy emotion. If a person never feels guilt, will they regret what they're doing? Right? So you have to understand, the emotion of fear, recoiling, taking caution, right, is healthy. It's not healthy when it turns into neurosis or compulsive behavior or a sense that everyone's out to get you. Okay? But that's what's happened. What's happened is, you know, I always quote the comic strip of Calvin and Hobbes, where Hobbes turns to Calvin and says, Calvin, do you believe in God? And he says, well, somebody's out to get me. Right? So that's how he knows there's a God. And that's so many people. They think that I know there's a God because he's out to get me. He's going to hurt me. That is not Jewish. Okay? That is not Jewish. But fear in Jewish tradition means fear of consequence. I'm not afraid of God. Right? But I am afraid of the consequences of my behavior because I know there are consequences to my behavior. So if I'm playing some, you know, if I'm a contestant in one of these game shows, right? And I've got to answer this question. All right? And this is it. I'm going to get the whole pot. $1 million or I walk away with a stuffed animal. Right? I'm not feeling love at this moment. I'm feeling scared. Right? But I'm not feeling scared of the MC, right, who's opening up the envelope at this moment to tell me the answer. But in that moment, my heart is beating really hard because I'm really scared I blew it and I just said the wrong answer. And I'm going to lose all of that. So I'm scared, but I'm not scared of him. He's not trying to hurt me. Right? So too, I'm not scared of God. God is never trying to hurt me. God is only trying to heal me. Right? And the word punishment is a very bad translation for onesh. Because really, I would call it a corrective measure. Okay? Punishment sounds like, you annoyed me, you hurt my ego, I'll get back at you. Right? That's what punishment kind of sounds like. But that's certainly not what it's about. You know, when I get sometimes letters from inmates, which is nice, because my books are in prisons. Because very often prison libraries look for religious inspiring books. So I've gotten a good few letters from prisoners, right? Jewish and not Jewish. And how do I know right away it's a letter from a prisoner? Because the return address is the Corrections Center of Arizona. So you're right away, what's a correction center? They don't call it prison, right? Jail. They call it correction centers. Because that's really what it is. It is a correction center. Okay? And that's what it's about. To be corrected. And so too, there are corrective measures in the universe. It's only trying to get me aligned with myself and my destiny. And I'm scared that if I make this move, I'm going to be out of the groove. And if I make this move, I could be in the groove. But I'm not scared of God. I know that God is not trying to hurt me, always trying to heal me. Right? Right? Because how could God try to hurt me when I'm... That would be as crazy as saying God's trying to hurt himself. Because I'm a part of myself. I mean, again, if my finger suddenly had an opportunity for self-realization, right? And it became cognitive of itself and was on a journey of self-discovery, it would experience itself as part of some greater being, right? And if suddenly I cut my finger, it wouldn't think, oh, how could you do this to me? You must hate me, right? You must be out to get me. It was like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm in just as much pain as you are. Oh, yeah? You really think so? You know? And I'm like, oh, is that ridiculous to think that God would try to hurt us when you realize it's like the sun trying to hurt a ray of itself, right? It's like, I'm trying to hurt my finger. It's that ridiculous. Why would God be trying to hurt a part of himself? All right. It's ridiculous.
So it's kind of like you're having this healthy fear of going, gosh, I really don't want to do something that's going to take me, that's going to get me off the course, that's going to take me out of the line.
Absolutely. You got it. I am scared. I'm scared of making the wrong move. I'm scared of doing things that will hurt myself and confuse myself because I know there are consequences to my behavior. So that's yira on the level of scared, fear. Yira on the level of reverence is a whole other experience, which is, I know that there is a wisdom that is greater than my own. So let's give an example. Let's say I'm driving down the street and I tune into the traffic report from my friendly man in the helicopter who's up there to tell me what's going on. Okay? So he says, don't go down Highway 1, it's jammed. Okay? Take a side street as fast as you can, get off the highway. So now I could say, I bet you this guy has some friend that's late to work. He's trying to clear the entire highway just for his friend. This is just a plot. This guy doesn't care about me. Why would he care about me? I don't believe him because I can see. Everything's fine. Right? So there couldn't be. Right? So as I'm driving down the street saying, heck, I'm not going to do that. And anyways, everyone else is going to listen to him, so I don't have to listen to him. Right? And so I'm driving along for 20 minutes feeling really happy because I knew I made the right decision. And then suddenly pile up and I'm sitting there for hours. Because now that's the difference. I wouldn't do it because I'm scared. When I turn on the helicopter news, he says, don't go down Highway 1. Okay, I won't, I won't. That's not what I feel. He says, don't go down Highway 1. I say, you know, he's got a bigger perspective than I do, and I have a lot of honor and respect for his perspective, right? So too, if I go to a doctor and the doctor suggests what I should do, then I don't do it because I love the doctor. You know what, Doc? I love you so much. I will take that medicine. You know, you don't do it because you love the doctor. You do because you have reverence for his wisdom. Right? You know that he's got the bigger picture. He's got a lot more experience. He knows this kind of thing, and he tells you. Okay? You're not scared of him. Okay? You're not doing it because you're scared. Now, you might do it because you're scared. Right? But you might do it because you revere his wisdom. Okay? So that's yira in terms of reverence. But yira also translates into awe. There's a whole other experience. It's when you're standing in front of the doctor and he tells you what to do, and it's not because you're scared that you're going to die, and not just because you have reverence for his wisdom, you're just in utter awe of this guy. Right? And you say, whatever you say, doc. Because I just know you're amazing. Right? And awe actually has an element of love and adoration. Admiring. Right? There's a sense of admiring. So those are three completely different translations of the word yira, and they're all valid, but you have to decide which one of those translations is the one you need in your life right now. And you know what? Generally, It's all translations. Sometimes to get myself motivated, I just use scare tactics, right? You do this, you're gonna get it, okay? You're gonna suffer the consequences, so don't do that. Okay? Now that's not the highest motivation. It's not the way you hope that you operate, but you know, sometimes it's just the way it works, right? But then sometimes you do it because tremendous reverence for the wisdom of Torah, knowing that there's a power that's more wise than I. And whoever built this planet, whoever designed this eyeball, pretty smart. You know, so if that same power that designed the eyeball and designed my eardrums, right, is suggesting very emphatically that I behave this way, I think I'll listen. You know, maybe there is someone who knows better than me. That's sometimes very relieving. Maybe there's somebody that knows better than me. That can bring a lot of peace to somebody. And then sometimes it's just the sheer awe, right? You know, it's just the sheer awe of the depth of Torah, the beauty of Shabbat, and I'm just in awe. So, you know, sometimes, and Rav Kook says that really we should aspire to the higher yira, awe, but don't ever, ever give up the lower yira. Because sometimes you just need it. Sometimes you gotta scare yourself to action. Okay? It's not so bad. But if it becomes the constant format, then it might just get too much that you just start rebelling and then you just run the other way. Yeah.
But what needs to be addressed now? Can you give an example?
Okay. You see, when I'm standing in shul on Yom Kippur, and they tell me that this is the time called Ni'ila, and the gates are closing, and they're going to be locked, okay? So as a child, I literally believed there were gates, they were closing, they'll be locked, I'll be locked out. I don't want to be locked out, right? I felt that being locked out of the house when I forgot my key at home. It's abandonment. Okay, fine. Now, if I still think at 48 years old that Yom Kippur, there really are some doors in heaven, that won't work for me, right? I just won't buy into that, because as I've evolved in my own self-awareness and awareness of the world and my awareness of God, that imagery, right, is great poetically and touches me emotionally, but doesn't satisfy me intellectually. And that's really the difference between biblical language and metaphysical language. When you pick up the Zohar and the writings of the Arizal, he communicates Judaism some metaphysical terminology. But when you pick up the Bible, you don't see any of this metaphysical terminology. There's God, and there's the finger of God, and there's the eye of God, and the splitting of the seas, and all that. So one philosopher, I can't remember who, I think it was Hegel, says that biblical, or he called it religious terminology, speaks to our emotions, right? But metaphysical terminology speaks to our intellect, right? So, you know, I can't feel love for the light of the endless light, you know? I can't feel that I have this personal relation with the Ein Sof, the endless one. So there's something lacking in the terminology. But on the other hand, I also don't feel so intellectually comfortable with God as some man in heaven with a beard, although that doesn't evoke some very genuine religious emotions. Okay? So remember, all of these are just some attempt to awaken within us the knowing that ultimately can't be put in words, okay? But we still need words. Words awaken, you know? You can say to somebody, I love you. Now, the truth is that what you're trying to communicate and the word love don't fit so well, especially the way love has been used over time. It's become so cheapened, okay? So, you know, sometimes you're in that incredible deep romantic moment where you just spontaneously say to this person, I love you, but then you feel stupid. And you almost feel like you desecrated the moment by trying to shove that moment in this stupid little word, love, that the Beatles were singing about all day long. I mean, like, you don't feel like, so you say, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry I even said that. No, I'm happy you said that. No. No. What I'm feeling for you is much more than love. Well, go ahead, keep saying more. No, it's really beyond words. No, but come on. So, you know, you're trapped as human beings. We're trying to express the inexpressible. Right? And that is just part of our journey that we have to do. So, I feel uncomfortable talking about God. But my job is to talk about God. But when I talk about God, I kind of turn myself off to what I really know and what I really believe and what I really live. But then again, nobody will come to class because I'll have nothing to say. So, you know, you're stuck. You're stuck in trying to explain something and recognizing how limiting it is and how at one point, the more you talk about it, the less people will get. But if you don't talk about it at all, then how will you communicate and they'll get anything? So this is the challenge of Judaism today, because we are very self-aware. We're deeply spiritually intuitive. And the forms of Judaism can facilitate an expression of that, but has anybody let us know how to plug the machine in? Right. How do we connect to that? So that's, you know, when I was a kid, I was told Shabbos, God worked for 6 days. Seventh day he rested. He wants you to rest. If you don't rest, you won't be at rest. And so you better do your best and keep Shabbos. And I, you know, so that was nice as a kid, but after a while, I don't believe that. I can't buy into that. Like, come on, 6 days? What does that mean? So you're right. Well, for the child, it's okay. But as you grow up, then you got to get deeper. Well, what does that really mean that God rested? And what do we really mean when we say God? Right? And then how do we help people experience? Because imagine, you know, people talking about water all day long, and you're thirsty. Does that quench your thirst? It just doesn't quench your thirst. It even makes you more frustrated. Right? Because nobody's giving you water. So same thing. You know, we could be talking about God all day long. Does that now mean we've experienced God? Okay? Well, but that's the problem. If a rabbi gets up in synagogue and just talks about God, but during the entire service everyone's talking to each other and not talking to God, well then we're in big trouble. Right? We're in big trouble because it's not... Our souls know we want some realization of who we are and who we're part of. Did that help?
Yes.
A little bit. Yes. What is fake?
The sense that you have, that you've been influenced by other ideas, but what you think you're tapping into the reality of who you are.
Yes, that's true. You might not be. Right? You know what the proof of the pudding will be? Is really how you behave. You know, a person could say, I'm really tapped into the light. I'm really connected. Right? And then be mean to the person next to them. Or then, sorry, that's not how divine light beams behave. So, that's what I mentioned before. I had this fellow who was meditating and contemplating his navel and naked and all that. But you know what? He really wasn't a mensch. Right? Didn't clean up his dishes, didn't respect the person next to him, wasn't even aware of the person next to him. But he thought he was so deeply connected to God and the spiritual experience. But in our tradition, we've got halacha, right? We've got a guideline and directives of what kind of behavior would truly reflect a person who's connected. So as I mentioned this morning with that Rebbe, who really, you know, anybody in their right mind truly connecting up with the Yom Kippur experience wouldn't eat, not because there's a law that says thou shalt not eat. They wouldn't eat because who's got time to eat? I'm so absorbed in trying to change my life. Right? So the halacha is essentially articulating a mode of behavior that actually would have been natural if we were connected, right? If we were connected to God, you know? And so that's the question. The bottom line is what you're saying, what you're doing. And that's what's so scary to me, anyways, in terms of this New Age thing, which is a person isn't genuinely spiritual if they are immoral, right? Right? It's like you can talk soul and all that, but if you're immoral or you're not humbling yourself before a power greater than yourself, then that's not genuine. Although the person might think they're genuine. Oh, a lot of people. Connected. You're right. You're right. And that's why halacha becomes, Jewish law becomes the sounding board, the barometer. Am I connected? Because if I were connected, then I would certainly live this way. Right? That's why it's good to have a Torah. It's almost like a mirror, but or a picture or a painting of you. Because really the goal of Judaism is to actualize the image of God you created in. Right? A light, a ray of light is in the image of the sun, so to speak. It's the ray of the sun. And so too, we are a ray of the divine, create the image of God. And so here's a picture. The Torah gives you a picture of what truly a ray of light would think like, speak like, and act like. Right? And if you fit that, you're connected. If you don't fit that, then to that extent, you're not so connected. Right. The Arizal had an amazing way of diagnosing people. Rav Isaac Luria would have people close their eyes and visualize the name of God. The Yud, the He, the Vav, the He. He would then ask them to describe what they can see. And people would say, well, gee, you know, I can't see the Yud, but I can see the other letters. Or I can't see the bottom of the Vav. Or well, he would ask them, what color is the letters? It's gold, it's purple, is there a background? It's actually white letters on a black background. And based on their visualization, he would then tell them what was wrong with them physically in terms of their ailments. And he would then prescribe a mitzvah, a commandment that they have been negligent in. Well, how does he do that? What does that mean? Because really, we are meant to be a living projection of the divine into the world. So our ability to visualize that name reflects how well we're doing that. Okay? And where are there disconnects? So this particular mitzvah, I'm not being enough attendant, paying enough attention to. So in that way, I'm disconnected and it's coming out in my visualization. Amazing. But that's really you can think you're connected, but you might not be connected. You could easily be fooling yourself. And Judaism claims that its tradition, its teachings, its lifestyle is an indication of truly being connected. Yes.
Okay, so it seems like the more that we connect to Hashem, the more difficult, I guess, and the bigger the struggle becomes. Like, it's kind of like, why do I want to? I'm almost afraid to grow because I don't know. Because it's overwhelming. Like, if I do this, then I'm but next I have to do this.
Right. So tell me, who has an easier life, you or a dog? You're right. Who do you think has an easier life, you or a goldfish? Absolutely right. My neighbors went on vacation and asked me if I could take care of their goldfish. And every day, with all my struggling, I walk in and see these goldfish. They drove me nuts. Right? They're totally happy. They're totally with it. Just floating along. There's this one fish that eats all the excrement of all the other fish. He's very happy. That's his job. So what is that thing on the bottom? Right? He just eats everybody's excrement. But he's really happy. Okay? And that is why primitive man idolized animals. If you go into museums, you will see that the original religious experience was a desire to be an animal. The holy man would wear animal masks. They would have images of animals because they want to go against the tide of the evolution of self-realization, of becoming aware of yourself. These animals are not aware of themselves. So this is the payoff, right? And yet this is also the price. Which is, as we become more self-conscious, we do become more complex. We do become more, we do struggle more.
Yeah, my question is more so, what exactly is the payoff? connection.
That payoff is just being you. And you don't have a choice in the matter, right? Except you could run, but you can't hide from you. And so that's just the direction we're going. We are going in the direction of self-discovery, self-realization, self-awareness. And as we become more aware, we become more aware of the choices that we can make. We become more aware of the people around us and the hurt that we can cause or the blessing we could bring. And look, I always say, before I lived the Torah life, life was a little, in a certain way, easier. Right, because before it was between, I know I'm trivializing it, but it was basically between Levi jeans or Lee's. It was between the rock concert or the disco. And now suddenly I gotta make choices about this amount of tzedakah of charity or that amount of tzedakah. And where should I put my tzedakah? And now I have to be aware of am I speaking lashon hara? Am I speaking properly? Am I using the power of my speech right or wrong? Judaism wasn't trying to make your life on one hand easier, but in a certain way it really does make your life easier. Because now you know what you're part of, now you know who you are, now you have some guidelines, right? So if you were a human being, but you thought you were a fish, you'd really be in trouble, right? Because you'd be so aware of all these other fish, right? You'd be really disgusted by that big one down on the bottom of the tank. And that's the problem, which is if you're a human, then you gotta act like one, there's no choice in the matter. Okay? So on one hand, the evolution, that coming to consciousness, which is what the human being is, makes life in a certain way more challenging, but in another way, a lot more fulfilling.
You just said you can't run away from you, but I think that you can. Mm-hmm. And I think that...
No, I said you can run, but you can't hide. That's like your body running away from your mind. You're still there. Like, as they say, where you run, there you are. So like, there's a certain point where you can run, and I think a lot of people spend their time running, but somehow they can't hide from themselves.
But in a different way, and I think that this pain, the emunah, or like how, what if they don't connect for you? The rituals don't connect the emunah.
Right. So that is part of the learning, which is how does one maintain the aha? And in my experience, living a Torah life now for 30 years, right, it works. I'm not always in the aha, but I'm 1,000 times more in the aha than I ever was when I was going to my rock concerts with my matches. Now I'm lighting Shabbos candles with the matches. But so the lifestyle is one that, as I mentioned, if I were to think of the antithesis of Jerusalem, I would say Times Square. Because it's just the opposite of being focused and centered. It's us being pulled at you in every direction. All the more so, I feel we need a lifestyle that grounds us, that focuses us, that we can surround ourselves with a framework that enables us to maintain that awareness. Now, we might not always be 100%, but being 10% is a lot more than some people that just seem to be zero, unconscious, sleepwalking, sleep talking, sleep thinking, and they are no longer in touch with self and the greater self. Okay? So the definition of emunah is not the aha. So I'm sorry if you got that impression, but the aha is a moment where you really taste what emunah is, but it shouldn't be a moment. It should be a momentum, right, that you're in constantly. Right, of that awareness, and sometimes going out of it is part of being in it. I mean, if I was always happy, would I know I'm happy? Right? No, because I'm always happy. So when I'm happy and then I have a low moment, then I remember, oh wait, I was happy. Oh, now I wish I could be happy again. I get to happiness. So you have to understand that the fluctuation is also part of consciousness. Part of consciousness. If someone who loved you was constantly caressing you, right? At first it would feel really good. After a while you wouldn't even notice it. Right? Until they stop. They say, hey, why'd you stop? Okay? So too, in a life of awareness, sometimes the stopping, right? That's what I love about Judaism. It doesn't say keep Shabbos all week long. There's 6 days where you're working, one day where you're resting. It actually creates the fluctuation that enables the awareness to happen, because there are contrasts. That creates, it's just the beauty of a painting, it's the contrast of the colors. Just as the beauty of music, it's the contrast of the different tones of tonality, right? That's creating the music in the first place. And so too the music of our minds, the music of that awareness, right? But I do want to qualify with this, I think we'll just end, or you can ask me more questions afterwards, privately. I think it's very important on 2 points. This idea of tikkun olam, like everything is fixing. But if you were a wrench, wouldn't that be what you want to be doing? Right? But that's what we are. We are tools to fix the world. And fulfillment would only come. A wrench that's being used as a doorstop would feel really bad about itself. Because I want to fix something, right? So too, we're not here to be doorstops. We're here to fix the world, so, and a wrench that's in a place that needs a lot of fixing would feel even happier. Like, whoa, I'm going to be useful in a place like this. Like, a wrench in my house won't be happy. Right? Because I don't like to fix things. I like to fix the world. A wrench, you know, my kids use it. Right? But a wrench that's in the shop of some technician, he must be a really happy wrench. Okay? So, we are wrenches. That's number one. Number two, you know, this, we gotta be so careful of numbers like 613. Like, first of all, most of them, you personally not responsible in. No, I know, but others hearing that really bottom line, if I looked at my daily activity in contrast to my daily activity before I embraced the Torah life, what am I really doing different? I am doing things different. Well, I pray 3 times a day, I put on my tefillin, I wear tzitzit, I make blessings on my food, and I continue to try not to kill and steal. I was kind of doing that before. In other words, like really when you think of it, well, so what did I do? So now, Shabbat, yes, that's a very big change, but I was always looking for some kind of rest on Sundays, but not necessarily such effective ways of resting. So really when you boil it down, it really doesn't demand that much, and yet it produces phenomenal results.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.